Hello, and welcome to the podcast for Agree to Disagree, broadcast as a part of Uproot, a public affairs program every other Sunday from 5 to 7 in Claremont, California on KSPC 88.7.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Uproot. This is Agree to Disagree, the political commentary show here at KSPC. Our dynamic trio is down to a dynamic duo tonight. Myself, Isaac Kasima, happy to be joined by Jake Petzold.
Evening.
Yeah, he's suffering a bit of a migraine, so forgive him for any mistakes or misspeaks, as well as myself, because I'm prone to them.
That's just for no reason.
That's for no reason at all. This evening, we thought, since it's just the two of us, we have a shared experience that's pretty awesome. We spent a semester in Washington, D.C., and where we had internships as part of the CMC Semester in D.C. program. So we thought tonight we'd share with you guys some of our experiences with that program. We actually had the privilege of living together.
What a privilege.
Really it was. So we've, of course, talked about between us our experiences before, but we thought, hey, why not share them with all of our wonderful listeners?
And I think there's also just sort of more generally a value to a discussion of the what life is like in D.C. at this moment, in particular for young people, in particular for students. So I think it will sort of extrapolate and extend the discussion beyond just our experiences.
And so kind of the way I wanted to start it off, the real important thing we had in D.C. was this internship component. The program, you're required to do a full-time internship. So it's 5 days a week. You're 9 to 5. And additionally, you have night classes 2 to 3 nights a week. And so that was our schedule, very busy. But I thought it'd be interesting to talk, if Jake wanted to talk about his internship, how he got it, what was his day-to-day like, and we could just start it off there.
Well, I was really fortunate because sort of, you know, I knew CMC had this great DC program when I decided to come to CMC, and even more so I anticipated that at some point in my college experience I'd be interning in Washington, D.C. And there was, I don't even know when I came across this, but at some point in high school I came across this website for this speech writing firm called West Wing Writers. And it was founded by, or it's at its core, our four former, the four partners are former Clinton White House speech writers. And it's just a small firm that does communications, mostly speech writing, for all sorts of clients. And I just, you know, I knew it as soon as I found that this place was out there, that this is something I wanted to do. And as we went through the application process, fast forward, you know, I knew I wanted to work there. I had for some time. And then fast forward to after I decided to go do DC program for spring 2010, where we need to send out a certain number of applications to all these places and, you know, submit copies to the off-campus study office and show them what we're doing. And there was really only one place I wanted to work, and that was West Wing Writers. And fortunately, just sort of as soon as I got my information in there and a cover letter, it just quickly, things fell into place. And I ended up working there starting in January with everyone else. I stayed on through the summer. So I was there for 7 months, and it was just really a great, great experience. It was sort of exactly it was more than I could have hoped for. It was exactly what I wanted, and it was just magnificent. I don't know if Isaac, if you want to introduce, sort of talk about what you did before specifics of my experience.
So for a couple of years, I've been working at, I'm from Washington State, and I've worked there on the state level for several lobbyists for now about 5 years. So when this opportunity came up to come to D.C., I gave him a call and said, hey, I need you guys, do you guys got any connections in D.C.? Can you guys find me something really cool to do? And they said, we have something in mind. So when I got to D.C., I was working for a group of, or several independent lobbyists. These are guys that have been on the Hill for, you know, 30 years. They started off as staffers. You know, they worked through campaigns. They've gotten to know everybody. And so now they're independent lobbyists who do a lot of contract work with big agencies. And so basically, I got to hang out with them for the whole semester and assist them in their day-to-day lobbying efforts. And that really consisted of direct lobbying. And so that was going out and actually meeting with the congressmen, going to fundraisers. There was a policy research component, a lot of strategy. So I really got to cover all the bases, but also as an intern, I was privileged to a lot of, just from the way I got the internship and that the way that the lobbyists kind of communicated together, I was really privileged to really get into the meat of it in a way that other interns couldn't. So I go to these fundraising events, I'd be on the Hill all day, and a lot of diversity in terms of what I was doing. So I really had a great time. And also got to see how that kind of the politics works at the national level. I've had a lot of experience at state level lobbying, but really, really getting into how the money aspect plays into how politics works.
Just out of curiosity, I don't think we've actually ever talked about this. Had those guys ever had an intern before, or shared an intern like this?
They had not shared an intern, but individually they had at some point some intern before. I mean, they've been up there for a long time. One of them, actually, Pat, who is the main lobbyist I worked for, one of his former interns is the governor of Maryland. of course, then he told me that he had high hopes for me. When I go forward,
that's some pressure.
So they've had a lot of exposure to interns, a lot of young people that they've worked with over the years. But I was kind of the first intern they'd had that they used collectively, and I think they really enjoyed having me there, not just so I could do some work with them, but it was an opportunity for them just to kind of share a lot of the war stories of the good old days, and I really appreciated that. That was a lot of fun to just hear them talk.
Yeah, you see, I was definitely not the first intern at West Wing Writers, although. I was sort of new in that their previous interns had either been local DC, Georgetown GW students, or specifically from the alma maters of the partners and associates in the firm, including the associates, the two associates who were there when I started had both been interns there and both went to, I'm sorry, at least one of them, just one of them went to, you know, was ended up in the job because he went to Yale, where one of the partners went, and they've recruited heavily out of those schools. But it was really just a great experience. I was the only full-time intern through the semester. And then during the summer, I was joined by three more, and they were all great fun. But just being there the day-to-day really exposed me to some, to just sort of the nature of this whole writing world. And, it's interesting, there are really only a handful of places that do what West Wing Writers does, maybe two really. It's a very insular world, the speech writing world. Everyone knows everyone. It's very small. It's a peculiar sort of narrow area, but most people come up from the political side. And so the speech writing world is based in Washington, D.C., even though the market is definitely not. And it was interesting to be at West Wing Writers at a time of relative expansion for them, as they're expanding their client list and also literally expanding their physical locations, as they open an office in New York and so forth. But going back sort of to, I guess, go from the macro, shift down to the micro, what I was doing, I think is probably more interesting, which is speech writing. One of the things, probably the biggest lesson I learned, was the degree to which good speech writing relies on good research. So I spent a lot of time researching, and I'd say actually probably everyone in the firm spends a lot more time reading than they do writing. And that was one of the things that I was sort of surprised by, and really interested by. Everyone does a lot more reading than they do writing, and research plays a much more foundational role in the speech writing process than I anticipated. That means statistics, it means history, it means anecdotes and jokes and everything. It means spending a lot of time finding connections between the speaker and the topic, between the speaker and the audience, historical connections, these sorts of things. For one client who was giving a speech, an American political figure who was giving a speech overseas in Kenya, I spent a lot of time researching what were the stories in the American papers about Kenyan independence? What was the immediate relation? And the speech that our client gave ended up talking about, alluded to the letters written from between Lyndon Johnson and President Kenyatta, the first president of an independent Kenya. These sorts of things, you're just digging in. And I will say, one of the things is, it must be really great for West Wing Writers to have these college student interns who spend much of their time on campus digging into LexisNexis and all these historical archives, because they're well prepared to do the research that's needed for these speeches.
Yeah, and I know you can't do some non-disclosure agreements. You can't reveal what specific projects you worked on, but you weren't just doing speech writing. You were doing a lot of different things, and for different people, not just your normal politicians.
Right. I went into it definitely expecting I mean, obviously the partners had come out of the Clinton White House, and I was definitely expecting, you know, an overwhelmingly political experience, but that's really wasn't the case. I'd say definitely most of our clients were not political. They were a mix of corporate clients, of foundation and think tank clients, and also some clients who were government clients, where West Wing Writers was a federal contractor, but not necessarily political per se. We had one long-term contract with an independent agency. So that was really interesting. I really appreciated the variety. It actually changed my sort of personal perspective on the communications profession, definitely broadened it and in a way that I enjoyed. And so not only were the clients diverse, so actually was the work that we did. Really sort of any written communication came under the projects that we did. So speeches are definitely number one, and presentations related to that. Op-eds have always been a part of the stable of what they offer at West Wing Writers, as have sort of white papers and policy proposals and discussions and so forth. And then I had a great privilege while I was there to work on a book, which I can't really say that much about, except to say, you know, we helped the author come up with a proposal and develop an outline, and then we went to work and, you know, through discussions, extensive discussions with the client, researching and writing the book and putting together in-house at West Wing Writers, which was really exciting.
Now, in light of just you learning that so many different types of communication that we hear from politicians or non-politicos is not actually original, but it's compiled by a speech writing firm or a firm that's going to ghostwrite a book. I mean, did you have any illusion about that before you came in, or were you just kind of accepting that maybe the memoirs we read from politicians really aren't their own works? And then how do we then feel about that?
You know, I think for the most part, the illusion of most of these figures writing their own speeches has been dispelled over the last 15, 20 years. For a lot of reasons. I mean, just sort of, I guess, I don't, I mean, I know some about the history of this because I've read about it, although I'm not going to proclaim myself emphatically an expert, but I can say that, you know, I mean, really there are, you know, sometime around Ronald Reagan, there was a rise of, I mean, I guess you go back, Ted Sorensen was Kennedy's special counselor and chief speechwriter and was really played a central figure in the administration, a central role in the administration outside of just his speechwriting responsibilities. But so he was famous, but then sort of going into the Reagan years, we saw an emergence and sort of a real identity, public identity of presidential speechwriters. And I think pretty consistently since then, we've been aware of their existence. And you know, TV shows like The West Wing certainly have exploded and that magnifying glass. So I didn't really, I wasn't surprised. I was, and it's in fact, it's a field that I've been interested in for a while. So it was sort of, I was definitely aware that this was out there. Although one of the interesting things to me is was looking at where the partisan breakdowns fall in terms of the work, you know, the speechwriters. Are they, which speechwriters work for whom? The Clinton, just by virtue of the fact that the partners at West Wing Writers came from the Clinton White House, the work they get, the political work they get comes from Democrats, but there was not really a sort of corresponding corporate or academic ideological breakdown, which is to say they worked for a lot of think tanks and corporations.
Well, I'm actually quite pleased that you have speech writers for politicians. I was privileged to attend many a fundraiser for congressmen in particular, and hear how they spoke. and oftentimes that they really did need a speechwriter because the things, the swear words, the things I heard coming out of congressman's mouth really, really could raise an eyebrow.
But I think that also speaks to the level of intimacy that you were offered in your job, which I was really exciting for me to live with you and hear stories about. You know, you really were getting full access. You were your bosses collectively and individually were really bringing you in. And it seems like you had a lot of sort of behind the scenes experiences that were
And there were a couple forums that I got to kind of dive into that really provided that. One of them was working for this group called the Missouri-Kansas Forum, and that's a group of essentially lobbyists that all represent interests in Missouri or Kansas, and they come together and they hold breakfasts once a month or sometimes twice a month, and they go to different events. And it was my responsibility to organize these breakfasts with all these different lobbyists or, you know, interest group people. And then at each one of those events, they'd have congressmen or multiple congressmen from those areas, or whether they're in leadership, they'd come. So I got to meet, you know, Congressman Ike Skelton several times. He was actually one of the lobbyists I worked for was a former chief of staff to Ike Skelton, who serves on the Armed Services Committee. So a very powerful member of the House. So, you know, you even get to joke with congressmen. And then you did pick up a bit of a relationship. And between that, hanging out at the Democratic National Club, where, you know, that's kind of where everybody would go for drinks afterwards. You know, if the congressmen didn't want a camera following them or any fear that anybody was going to tape them doing anything, they'd go to the Democratic National Club. Also hang out in the Capitol Hill Club, which is where the Republicans got to hang out. So for the most part, I was really dealing with a lot of Democratic candidates, but we also had a fair number of Republicans. I'd say it was probably about 70% Democrat, 30% Republican. And we covered a whole bunch of issues, and that was a luxury I had by working for multiple lobbyists. One of the lobbyists specialized in more land use, agriculture. He did stuff with arid lands and sciences and higher education. Some of the other lobbyists had a real emphasis in maritime and defense. There were a couple other ones that were in there. There was a healthcare, a hospital system. There was a couple, like I said, higher education institutions. Then you had these little things. One really cool thing I got to work on was the Havasupai tribe in Arizona, and they were an Indian tribe that was trying to protest pollution of uranium mining that was coming down the Colorado River. And they they rely on this river, and so they wanted to make sure that new regulations were passed for that. So that was very small. But on the other end, we had General Dynamics, and General Dynamics is very large, and they wanted, you know, pass $1 million tanker deals and succeed there. So it was a great range, and that range also exposed me to a lot of different congressmen and congresswomen, because, you know, if I would have been just in maritime or just in defense or just in these areas, I would have become pretty intimate with a small group of congressmen, but actually I got to meet quite a few. And then the one thing you also learn when it comes to campaign donations, which was really the big part of my job, which was carrying around checks of thousands of dollars in them and, you know, handing them to somebody, you really get a feel for how congressmen interact with each other and then how they interact with lobbyists. And that really surprised me in many ways. The level of connection that lobbyists, congressmen have to each other when it concerns money. I don't think there's much of a personal connection, which is something that I think Jake and I have talked about, but I also talked with other congressmen about, which is they're no longer inviting their families over to dinner like they did back in the good old days. So there's not that personal connection the congressmen feel, but there's this connection around money. And when congressmen are talking to each other, they're all trying to share donors. And so you'd go to an event with one congressman, and the other congressman was there because he was trying to, if you hadn't donated to him, he wanted to come up to you and say, hey, you know, I could really help you on your issue. Consider donating to my campaign. And it was a bizarre world that revolved around money. You know, I can't tell you how many times I'd be sitting in my office, be at my computer, and then I'd hear someone in the other room go, oh, hello, Senator. And the senator, you come in my room or my office afterwards and be like, wow. I just got shaken down by a U.S. senator for a donation. It was a bizarre world to live in, but it was really interesting to see how it works. I'm someone who's put a lot of attention into how you reform, basically reform government and interest group participation, something I'm very concerned about. And so having that perspective, seeing how it really works on the ground, on that real, the level of where it's actually you're exchanging money. And there's different types of lobbying. There's the lobbying that takes place on K Street, which is largely policy research. So they're researching policies, and then they take that and they bring that to congressmen. And this really was just playing hardball. You know, $2,000-$3,000 checks just going back and forth.
So I guess, you know, you're expressing some surprise here. I'm wondering, how does this compare to your experience on the state level in Washington?
Well, the state level, it is similar in a way. I think there's... people don't pay attention to it as much. There's not as much publicity around how much a congressman or a state senator is receiving from certain interest group as opposed to a U.S. senator. They don't have the same regulations usually, and that's true of most states. They don't have the same level of regulations and disclosure. So what I found on the state level is that lobbyists and politicians actually are quite friendly, even from a non-money standpoint. Part of it is that senators and representatives on the state level don't have huge staffs, and lobbyists kind of have they're much more relaxed and flowing around, and they're in the conversation. You're more likely to have a lobbyist in a room taking a picture with a governor. One thing that you'll never really find in D.C. is a congressman taking a picture with a lobbyist.
Right.
They'll take their money, but they're not going to want to be posing a picture. But back in Washington State, it's not unusual. A governor might be signing a bill, and when she's signing the bill, she has lobbyists all around her. So there's not the kind of – I don't feel like there's the same dirty eye that people have at the national level. And to the extent that there is a dirty eye, I think those ideas are – really a function of what people think of lobbyists on the national level. So you get the sense that there's much more fluidity now. Maybe a state level is like what lobbying at the national level was before McCain-Feingold or before a lot of these different reforms. You get the sense that as a lobbyist, you have a lot more freedom. You're not restrained.
So just jumping back for a minute to tie this into some pressing contemporary question. I was wondering, do you think you said the partisan breakdown in terms of the members you were dealing with was probably about 70 Democrat, 30 Republican? And I guess I'm wondering, is that a reflection, do you think, of those lobbyists and of your clients? Or do you think that's a reflection of the power structure, the fact that Democrats are in the majority right now? Do you think that Republicans, should they take the House or the Senate? Or, I mean, either or both, however, whatever, should they be in the majority in Congress? Do you think that there will be a flip? What was your sense of the lobbying world? Is it all about who's in now, or are there lasting ideological?
A lot of what it really has to do with is committees and who's on the committees, because you have, for the most part, lobbyists specialize. That's just something they do. They try to specialize. They get to know certain members really well. They get to know certain staff really well, and who they end up representing is often a function of which congressmen or senators that they build those relationships with, which offices they know. So when you're trying to get a new client, they might ask, all right, what's your experience with these people on this committee? So let's just say it's the Armed Services Committee. And to the extent that so if you're on the Armed Services Committee, if you have a client that cares about the Armed Services, you know everybody on the Armed Services Committee. You know the Republicans, you know the Democrats, and you're friendly with all of them. And when this shifts, if it shifts to more 50-50 split or Republicans controlling like a committee situation, they might actually do okay because they're really concerned about the committee work as opposed to the more national issues, because they're lobbying to get those bills through that committee. And a lobbyist doesn't have to be concerned about the different politics on a whole bunch of issues. They're fighting for their client. They're representing their client interests. So to the extent that their clients will be harmed in those committees by a takeover, and there's some that will, one of the groups we represented was the Seafarers International Union. It's highly likely that Republicans will not favor union issues like Democrats have. I mean, I think that's a given. And so that might be more difficult. The great thing about being a lobbyist is that the more difficult your work is, that actually benefits you it benefits the lobbyists, doesn't hurt them.
Yeah.
Right now, I think on a lot of things, they can kind of, it's not easy, but you can kind of just say, okay, I know these people that are in charge. I'm on good terms with them. If I go to them with this and I propose I make a sensible proposal, there you go. And it gets harder, but as it gets harder, you can raise your rates. So some lobbyists, their work will get harder, but you shouldn't feel bad for them, because
I don't think anyone feels bad for lobbyists ever.
Yeah, but and the interests recognize that, and the one thing that I've learned is that when you're lobbying, it's really about managing your client expectations more than it is delivering for your client. It is in your interest to tell
you, this is the Isaac we know and love.
It is in your interest to tell your client that whatever they want is impossible to get. So if you want to say that, to get that passed, you don't want to be like, I'm going to go do that for you. You want to say, listen, that's really, really, really hard. And you have a 90% chance that will not pass. And if it does pass, you're like, great, see, I'm that awesome. And they give you lots of money. But if it doesn't, you have built in so much that you're saying, this is impossible. That if it doesn't happen, it's not really your fault. I mean, they can gauge who's a good lobbyist, who's not. I mean, there are those situations. But lobbyists don't really have a lot of control, and political winds change, you know, by the day or by the hour, and interests know, and a good lobbyist tells their interest that they shouldn't expect that every time they're going to win. That's just not how it works. You don't matter how much money you throw at it. And there's only a few interests that really have the money, and I'm talking like, you know, health insurance or big oil. There's only a few interests that really have the money to really influence what's happening in Congress. It's really few. Most people are not spending hundreds of millions of dollars on ad campaigns or lobbying, or tens of millions, or not even a million. Most groups are spending several thousand or 100,000. It's not as, not everybody is big money. And we think of how many thousands of interest groups there are. Not everybody is a power player.
Right.
So they don't have the expectation that they're going to win.
As we have just a couple minutes left, I guess I was wondering what you thought about being in D.C., particularly at this time. While we were there, healthcare reform was passed and signed into law, these sorts of things. And just sort of D.C. in general, what was your sense of the place and of our political atmosphere, you know, through your 6 months there, just on the biggest scale?
I think my first month there, or something about D.C., is that everybody, when they get into their late 20s, 30s, they leave D.C.
Yeah,
They all move to, you know, Virginia, Bethesda. They're everywhere except, you know, in the city. And when I first arrived that first month, I could not figure out why that was the case. I thought D.C. was so awesome. Like, why would anybody want to leave here? Great townhomes, the city's alive, you know, you're going to bars and you're meeting all these politicos and you're just having a great time and you're in it. And I think after 6 months there, it was exhausting because you're working all the time, even when you go to a bar. You have to be careful who you talk to at a bar. Yep. Letting your guard down is not something you can do easily, particularly if you're someone who's very influential. I imagine for chiefs of staff and, you know, big staffers or political people, that's a hard city to stay in just because you're going to be under constant, you know, people are just be on you all the time. They're going to be trying to talk to you, try to engage with you. And so it is exhausting and it's a lot of fun. I think that I would very much like to be part in D.C. someday or have some, you know, work there. I think that'd be a lot of fun. But the city itself, it's a tiring city.
Yeah.
Very tiring.
Absolutely. I that was my experience. And I think tiring, you know, I sort of came to the same conclusion, but for a slightly different reason, which is to me, just the city does everything together. Yeah, there are other sides. Yeah, they're fighting all the time. But everyone thinks the same. I mean, there is this place, no other place is so ruled by conventional wisdom. I mean, everyone breathes together. Everyone thinks about, you might think differently, but you're thinking about the same things. And you're thinking about them basically because Mike Allen or someone, you know, who or someone else told you to. You know, everyone is doing the same thing at the same time. Everyone's talking about Stanley McChrystal for 2 weeks. And you know, outside, yes, the rest of the world cares. But the Stanley McChrystal story mattered to people, to most Americans in their lives for maybe 2 days. But in D.C., that was 2 weeks.
Yeah.
You know, will he, won't he? What's the post game? This sort of stuff is just exhausting. And you know, it took a step back and a return. For me, it was really apparent when I came back home in the middle, at the very beginning of the summer. So I was going back to D.C. for the entire summer. But I came home for my brother's high school graduation, and I took a step back and looked around and sort of remembered, like, this stuff doesn't all matter to most people on a day-to-day level as it does in D.C. Yeah. And that's, you know, and then it just, you know, just beats you up.
Yeah, I really unplugged when I came back. And, I still haven't quite plugged back yet. I mean, when I think that every morning when I was in D.C., I was spending like 2 hours just coming up to date on what the political stories were, and now I'm like, okay, I'll give it a 10 minutes.
I'm exactly the same place.
Because you just can't keep it up.
No.
And it does seem kind of silly often.
Yeah, it's an untenable. It's an untenable rate unless you have to do it.
Unless you have to do it, exactly.
And if you're in D.C., you do have to. Everyone has to. Yeah. That's the way it works.
You can't be someone in D.C. and then not be plugged into everything.
Yeah.
So
there's no halfway.
Yeah. Well, everybody, that's the end of our conversation. I really thank you for tuning in. KSPC Uproot will be back in 2 weeks. And so I hope you have a great week.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Agree to Disagree podcast edition, KSPC Uproot. Come back on October 24th for our next segment.